children were properly taken care of, you know, at the time. Because he said, in other words, the deity worship itself becomes third class because we're worshiping Krishna, and yet we're failing to recognize Krishna in the heart of the child. So I think on many occasions he really emphasized how important it is to take care of the children. On the other hand, so many of our activities, the children can be involved in some way. You know, I mean, when we first moved in the temple, like one of my first services was going to the flower shop and getting, you know, the flowers for the temple. And, you know, I'd bring my children along and they've learned how to deal with the people, you know, like who weren't devotees and actually really participated. So I think that with Namhata programs and cooking and things like that, at least when the children are a little bit of age, they can actually be engaged and make it a family project. You know, then older children can watch littler children. You know, it's just, I don't see why there should be such a contradiction, you know.
Prabhupada said that sometimes the taking care of children can be organized. It is not that each mother has to take care of her own child all the time. And that to facilitate service, one can have some, if it's properly done and carefully done, the children can be organized for like some kind of, like a daycare or something like that, where they can have spiritual activities. Just like, during our Sunday feast, we have a Sunday school. So at least the children, the parents are freed up, and the children are all, you know, coloring pictures of Krishna and Ram and so on like that. So at least the temple service, the children can be taken care of. If it's done nicely, it's very good. They should not be neglected under any case. And even if we have somebody taking care of children, some of the older children, some of the older girls, you know, it's the responsibility of the parents to make sure that that's being done in a nice way. But that's possible.
And it's important, not the children are not just, they're not like sort of, you know, Maya. They're actually taking care of children properly is a service.
Yeah, it's the Bhakti program,
yeah.
Remember that.
So, yeah, to do it with an idea, you're serving Krishna in this way, you know. So like any service, you do it the best you can, you know.
And then in the same question, it is asked that apart from the financial support which the husband brings, should the husband also play a vital role in raising the children and taking care of them, or should it be the responsibility of the mother only?
No, children require two parents. That's why they're two. And that's why actually they require the full contribution of feminine qualities and also the full contribution of masculine qualities. So they need both mother and father. Now the role they play is quite different, and it's usually the fact that the husband's not around traditionally as much as the mother, and so the mother usually has closer care, especially in the early years. Then after they're six, then the tradition is at least the boys are sent to a spiritual master even, and so both play something of a lesser role while this is going on. But the children should not be neglected by the father. And Prabhupada seemed to think that he was brought up very well. And so if you read from his statements that are reproduced in Prabhupada Lilamrita, you found how much his father actually took care of him and bought him two guns, one for each hand, and you know, the spoiling principle of Chanakya Pandit's Prabhupada seems to have benefited from that. So both parents need to make their contribution.
I wanted to mention that most of the time we've always lived in the temple, or you know, in the Grihastha Ashram section of it, but there were maybe altogether about 3 years that we lived in an apartment nearby where my husband, especially when he was working on his dissertation. And it was a little difficult for me So once, in, maybe once or twice a month, Prabhu would just stay with our youngest child. The older children were in Gurukula, but stay with the, our youngest child while, you know, I would go to Mangalwarti, the whole program, and just get, you know, solid association of devotees and the deity worship, which was important to me. And I found that having that big chunk of time without other responsibilities was very nice. It gave me a lot of strength, you know, and I found that really nice. So, you know, we want to help each other in that way, not, you know, make the role so rigid or something that we can't be all Krishna conscious. Anyway, I appreciate it.
So we are approaching towards the end of this seminar. We have four or five more questions left. The next one is, in most of our grihastha homes, we have TVs. The children need to watch children's programs in order not to be, quote, left out, unquote. But in this process, they're exposed to violent movies as well, and thus they become TV maniacs. So how to solve this situation?
There's a lot of literature by ISKCON devotees about the evils of television on children and why we should get rid of them. And we should do everything we can not to expose our children to television. I understand the difficulty, and I had a child at home and there was a television, and I wish now somehow I hadn't done it. It was one of my mistakes. Because two of my children went all the way through Gurukula, but one it wasn't possible, and so we sent him to a non-devotee school. And if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't do it. I'd rather teach him at home myself and stop doing everything else than send him to a non-devotee school. Well, anyway, what's done is done. I can't undo it. And so it was the same thing. Well, he was going to a non-devotee school, and he was completely out of it, and all his schoolmates knew about, you know, I don't know, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and all these other fascinating characters. And so, you know, we caved in to the incessant demands, and he got a television and all that other stuff. And the only good thing was that finally, by the time he got to be, 15 or 16, he was so bored with it because it was so stupid. He couldn't even stand it anymore. But I still think it had a bad effect. It definitely had a bad effect.
The violence, it's the bad effect. I mean, look how violent our Krishna book stories are. I mean, that's violent. But I think
that's
a lot of...
That's right, isn't it?
Huh? It's partly with the advertisements. It's like set up just, you know, a dancing in front of you, all these things to enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. It's a whole kind of consciousness. And the other thing about it is, I think it's also the medium itself. It creates a very passive attitude. You just sort of sit there, and you know, things come to you. And maybe I was fortunate. I lived where we were, grew up without television. It wasn't possible in the valley that I lived in until I was, you know, a teenager. And I think the medium itself, you know, has that bad effect. Even our youngest one, Rupa, was about 10. Somebody gave him a little television, and as Prabhu said, I don't think it's so good.
Well, the children of mine that went to Gurukula, it was very interesting that the even the idea of sense gratification, they didn't quite really understand it fully as much as my one son who didn't go to a Gurukula and went to a... he got the idea of sense gratification very early on. My oldest son went to the Vrindavan Gurukul. You know, we sent him far away to Vrindavan and all this other stuff. But those kids, you know, they were so intent. One kid would be flying home on Pan Am. So from, you know, New York to Vrindavan, or, you know, from Delhi to New York is what? Three movies. And these kids were brilliant. They would memorize the movies so that when they got back, you know, they could tell all the other kids, you know, almost scene for scene, what happened in the film. And, you know, they had the Gurukula kids, they had, I mean, he was a kid who came home from Vrindavan Gurukul at the age of 16. He knew the lyrics to all the Beatles songs. They were geniuses at finding this stuff out. So there's a limit to what you can do. I understand that. And even, you know, in this in austere Vrindavan and away from all the Maya, they managed to they're curious. And but still, we should do what we can. It's clear that really, if we take this obligation here to produce saintly persons and to raise children, we have to ultimately create a culture of such completeness and, what shall I call it, density, that the children can be fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness. Their minds are active. They're very busy. They need stimulation of an intellectual and sensory nature. And ultimately, it has to be given to them through Krishna consciousness. And right now, we don't have everything to compete with television and all these other kind of things. Neither do we have a complete enough culture that they can grow up and associate mostly with devotee children and things like that. So it's really, the faster we develop along those lines, I think the better off we'll be for ourselves and our progeny.
I think in Juhu, I once saw it at the audiovisual department of the temple. They have a cartoon now on Ramayana.
Yeah, that's there. All that stuff can be done. We can take all that stuff. I mean, Bhakti Chuswami is interested in doing this. You know, he's got all the software that produced Jurassic Park. So we have potential. I mean, the material we have is fantastic. All we need is the money. But just that's number three.
Three more questions. At what age should a child be made to start chanting seriously on Tulsi beads?
Oh, I think they're statements from Prabhupada on this, that you can't force them. Because if you force them, then they'll hate the chanting of Hare Krishna. And so I've seen young Gurukul classes, they'll spend a little bit of time chanting on the beads, but people aren't so careful about, you know, how many rounds you chant and stuff like that. But I don't remember the...
What happened was he actually suggested in the Gurukulas that they, you know, just chant without beads. But because the children saw the adults chanting with beads, they all wanted beads. So sometimes they would go back and forth. And I do know, the one family, one of our families in Philadelphia, the Mahajans, they started having each day. Their family chants one round of japa today together. You know, of course, the parents chant more, but the children always, they would once a day get together usually in the evening and chant. And I don't think there's any harm by the time they're five, you know, to be able to learn to hold the beads and do it. But yeah, you don't want it to be something that's where they, you know, think it's really horrible. Neither do we want to say that we can't, you know, make them, you know, do something that's good for them, you know. And those children, the oldest one's now her second year of college, and the boy is in his teens, and the youngest one's about 12, and they still very faithfully chant that round together. And the children themselves said they really think that's really what's helped them.
I remember seeing one Gurukula class of young boys. They must have been like 6 or 7. They all sat down with their Tulsi beads, they were chanting Hare Krishna, and I watched what their hands were doing. It was so funny, you know. They would finish a round and, you know, in 2 minutes. But, you know, they liked the idea of chanting on the beads. And nobody was on their case, so it was nice.
In ISKCON, devotees don't marry at an ideal age, but later. How can this be avoided?
Marry earlier? usually the reason it's later, I guess, is because of economic considerations. Unfortunately, you know, practically no one can earn a decent living without a college degree, and this postpones things. People want their daughters to be educated now, because who knows, you may end up divorced and have to take care of yourself. You know, if there was like complete security, then probably most people wouldn't think it was necessary. But people think, well, you know, my daughter may end up on her own with a couple of kids or something and no husband. Well, they, you know, we have to watch out for it. So these are the social conditions we live under. I guess in a general way, one day, you know, right now maybe society is changing us. One day we're going to have to change society. And the sooner the better. That's all I can say about that.
It is observed that in ISKCON, in marriages which have been arranged by the gurus, right, haven't lasted. And then the couples had a tendency to blame the gurus. How can that be seen in a Krishna conscious way and avoid blaming the spiritual mess?
It's interesting, Prabhupada arranged a whole lot of marriages that didn't last, and nobody blamed him. Why is that? But if, you know, I arrange a marriage, I don't arrange marriages personally, but anyway, so some people, they still want to follow that system and they arrange marriages. Why should you blame somebody else who didn't blame Prabhupada? So if this happens, you know, the people whose marriage fell apart, although it was arranged by Prabhupada, they accepted that actually, you know, this was the appropriate thing and we just weren't up for it. Generally, it's a fact that if the husband and wife are Krishna conscious, in fact, you can put anybody together with anybody and it'll work out, you know. But that if is a big if. And sometimes spiritual masters just don't count on Maya, you know. They think everybody's going to be as Krishna conscious as they should be. So we have to say that if it doesn't work out, it's because we weren't Krishna conscious. I mean, Prabhupada didn't do anything when he arranged the marriages. He didn't consult astrology. He didn't consult you get married. That's what he did. But it's a fact. Nobody blamed him. You should extend the same courtesy to other people.
I also know a situation where it's not exactly marriage, but early in the movement there was some one god sister of mine named Shilavati, and she came to the movement. She had some young boys, and there was a question what should be done, and Prabhupada suggested that they go to New Vrindavan and get some schooling there, whatever. And anyway, the boys ended up leaving the movement quite bitter and had bad experiences, and they left, you know. So Shilavati and was speaking with Srila Prabhupada, and Srila Prabhupada said, you know, where did we go wrong? He didn't say, where did I go wrong or where did you go wrong, you know. So, of course, I don't know the situation exactly how, you know, various gurus do it. But I think that people have to, you know, have some, they should have some input somewhat, you know, at least to say no or whatever. You know, I think if you're the person that has to live with the person for your whole life, so I think it's important to try to in a respectful way, say at least I want to, you know something about the person. You know, I really would urge people to, you know, speak up to their guru and say, you know, and I do know devotees who, you know, their spiritual master was arranging a marriage, but they said no because they could see they weren't compatible. So I would, you know, suggest it, and I hope I don't get myself into trouble, but, you know, I think it's serious.
That's my policy, at least, that people have a veto power, you know. That I may think that these two people ought to be married together. I may make a suggestion, but I let them say no. That way I don't get blamed.
We have two more questions. Can Maharaj please explain what is the view of persons with very bad health and need major operation, for example, heart operation? Is having a major operation an over-endeavor? And one should accept the bad hell as Krishna's will?
I think it's hard for me to answer on a general principle. At this point, something that you would have thought a few years ago was an over endeavor, now is, you know, something that was a major operation is now even relatively minor because they've become so routine. So I don't know what the operation is. If it's a heart transplant, I'd definitely say it's an over endeavor. But if it's angioplasty or something like that, or even what do you call it, where you put in new veins in the heart from the leg, what is that called?
A bypass,
you know, quadruple bypass surgery, whatever. Maybe not. It depends on a person's own faith, you know. Just like, you know, Prabhupada told us once when I was a new devotee, we were told that prasadam is always holy and sacred. And so what we used to do should never be thrown away. So after the Sunday feast, they would take all the guest plates that didn't finish and they put it on a big pile. And Monday morning, that's what we had for breakfast. The remnants from the guest plates. They called it merge. Because it was all merged together, you know, and we used to have to eat it. And it was a little hard, you know. But if you didn't eat it, you didn't eat. So I used to eat it until one day, you know, I bit down in this prasadam and there was something in my mouth and I spit it out and it was somebody's bubble gum. And of course, I started to gag almost. And I said, that's it, you know. Maybe it can't be contaminated, but this bubble gum by... So then Prabhupada said, then a letter came from Prabhupada, somebody asked Prabhupada. Prabhupada was a little surprised that we were doing this. And he said, no, they don't have to eat. Well, isn't it pure? And Prabhupada said, yes. He said, but it depends on your faith. So this is something else that depends on your faith. Now, I have a couple of devotees in my area that have actually had kidney transplant surgery anyway. You know, the wife got one of the husband's kidneys. Well, I mean, kidney was available, and he didn't mind sharing, and there was money to pay for it from somewhere. They didn't even ask me, you know, and in any case, they were living outside. It was their... They must probably ask somebody. Maybe I wasn't their spiritual master. He must have advised them. But I didn't tell them it was wrong to do that. So it depends on your faith that you can accept something as Krishna's mercy. Certainly, you know, you can say, yeah, the disease is coming from Krishna, so therefore I shouldn't seek out medical treatment. But after all, medical treatment is immediately available and it works. You know, that's also Krishna's mercy too. So you can't go on that only. So I would judge on the circumstances when something becomes an over endeavor.
Even if the couple do not want kids, can they still indulge? We have that last question and then we'll finish. Even if the couple do not want kids, can they still indulge in sex life once a month?
Prabhupada, I just read you what Prabhupada said. The only really Krishna conscious use of sex life is to beget God conscious children. So for your spiritual advancement, it's better not to.
Well, we have covered, I think, most of the questions. We would like you to bear with us for the next 10 minutes because that's very, very important. At this stage, I would call upon Lokabandhu Prabhu to explain to you what's going to happen. It's not going to take long, just about 7 to 10 minutes. And then, Maharaj, you have one last question though. And the question is, could you please do the final kirtan before the end? Thank you.
at this stage in the afternoon, I know it's been quite a long day for all of us, but I think in order to bring the seminar to a very fitting conclusion, the proceedings have to be completed. So what we propose to do is to ask three of the devotees who have attended the seminar yesterday and today, in a 2 minute, it's going to be very, very precise personal realizations of how they have received this seminar. So the first person we are calling upon is Raj Ramprasad. He's been a devotee for many years and also a retired school principal and also very firmly entrenched, if I may say so, in the Grihastha ashram. So Raj Ramprasad, please come forward.
Very few words, because I know there's meetings that have probably maybe started already, perhaps, and we have other things to do. I just want to thank you all very, very much. It's true I've been asked to say something about attachment to Krishna and detachment to Maya, and that's an important point, because none of the strict following of the Grihastha ashram would be possible unless we are absorbed in Krishna service. We have to have an emotional life with Krishna, and we have to have engagement of the senses in Krishna service. And the more deeply we're engaged, the easier it will to give up our attachment to illusion. The Prabhupada says in one of those quotations, we have to become free from involvement in the illusory family and enter into the real family of Krishna consciousness. And so the more we are involved with intensity in Krishna service, the easier all these things that seem so difficult will be. And actually, it'll turn out that when we finally achieve Krishna consciousness, we'll be kicking ourselves because it turned out to be so much easier than we thought, and I really wasted so much time not being Krishna conscious when I could have been so easily. And I just want to thank all of you for being such a wonderful and receptive audience. And I've come and spoken these things to find that people have taken them to heart and it's helped them. That's really all the thanks I need, and I feel greatly thanked. So thank you. Hare Krishna. Just a short kirtan, huh? Nama Om Vishnu Paraya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Yuti Nami. Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharini Nibhishesha Sanyavari Achatya Desha Tarine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Prakarine Nivishesha Chunavadi Pachata Deshatarine Murti Krishna Chetana Prabhu Nityananda Priya Deva Gadada Kriva Sadhi Gura Tavinda Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitananda
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.